live from New York City. It's the Gary Knoll Show.
This will be an everlasting love. This will be the one I've waited for. This will be the first time anyone has loved me.
And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. On location today, we're going to give you the latest on health and healing, then I'm going to do a special, in-depth, original, investigative reported white paper on the environment. How much time do we have, and how bad is it? This is important. This is part three of an ongoing series of telling the truth based upon the best science there is about how little time we have and how we're filled with hubris and indifference. We're not only not doing anything to reverse and stop global warming, we're actually accelerating it. I'll deal with that on today's show in a special report, and it will be posted on PRN.fm. I also have a guest on today's program who's going to talk about autism and brand new information from J.P. Handley about what a group of scientists, separate from each other, working in Europe, have discovered about the real cause of autism. Now, this is important information. We'll share that with you as well. We always begin with the latest on health and healing, and this comes from Trupai Hospital and Santai Center in India. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Biomed Research International, and it shows that how ashwagandha, ashwagandha, is associated with improving female sexual functioning. That's good. And if this was among women who took the ashwagandha root on a regular basis, they were from 21 to 50 years of age, and they had female sexual dysfunction, which included hypoactive sexual desire disorder, female sexual arousal disorder, female orgasmic disorder, and combined genital and subjective arousal disorder, meaning they just didn't feel anything. They had no desire, no libido, etc. All they took was 300 milligrams, that's not a lot, of ashwagandha twice a day with their food, or they took a placebo, an inert tablet, for 8 weeks. And the sexual function, meaning desire, arousal, lubrication, orgasm, satisfaction, all increased. And sexual distress and lack of sexual response decreased. So that's important. Something else to help people. From University of California at Irvine, a study that acupuncture lowers hypertension by activating a natural opiates. Now, researchers with the Susan Samui Center for Integrative Medicine have found that regular electroacupuncture treatment can lower hypertension, which is high blood pressure, by increasing the release of a kind of opiate in the brainstem region that controls blood pressure. That's good. This was published in Nature Scientific Reports. Also, supplementation with vitamin C and vitamin E is associated with a decreased risk of cognitive impairment and dementia. This is from the Quebec Research Center, published in the Annals of Pharmacotherapy. And it just showed that the more vitamin C and E that you take, the lower your risk of developing cognitive decline among both men and women as they age. And they were investigating 5,269 men and women in this Canadian study of health and aging. And that's what they found. So take your vitamin C and vitamin E and help to ward off Alzheimer's. And by the way, they followed up for 11 years and found that it's still sustained. 30% lower adjusted risk of all-cause dementia and 40% lower risk of Alzheimer's. And great improvement in cognitive cognition. So vitamin C, vitamin E, two natural, easy, inexpensive ways of helping yourself. from the University of Technology, which is in Sydney, Australia, how your diet can influence your environmental impact. Now, the impact of our dietary choices on the global phosphorus footprint shouldn't be neglected. I've mentioned many times that the Great Mississippi, the Mark Twain Mississippi, and by the way, Mark Twain wasn't his real name, Samuel Clemens was his real name, but Mark is a measure in the depth of the water, and so he took on that name. He loved the Mississippi, but the Mississippi that he grew up on and how it emptied into the Gulf of Mexico is totally different than the Mississippi today. And I've gone down the Mississippi River to film, to research, and there's now a gigantic dead zone the size of New Jersey at the mouth of the Mississippi, and that's in part because of phosphorus, synthetic, artificial fertilizers. All those farms, those thousands upon thousands of farms, they all wash every winter when the ground freezes and they don't put a green cover crop on, which they don't. They should. They could put organic soy on, and then over the winter, the soil's protected. And then in the spring, they plow that under, and that becomes what's called a green fertilizer. It enriches the soil. That's how you keep the soil healthy. But instead, to save money, they leave it barren, so the ice and snow over the winter and into the spring, it creates all these cracks, and those cracks then lead to, when it rains in the spring, all that loose soil washes off, good topsoil washes off, goes into tributaries, estuaries, streams, and then into the Missouri or Mississippi River. And it's loaded with chemicals. And that chemicals then creates algae blooms, and that suffocates the fish because it deprives the water of oxygen. And fish need oxygen. So the impact of what you eat, meaning is it organically grown on a small sustainable farm? Is it where they do no-till growing, a Steiner method, Rudolf Steiner method, which is biodynamic and very good, hydroponic, very good, use 93% less water? No, the average person just eats what they want to eat. They don't care how it was grown, where it was grown, or the consequences of that, nor do they even care about their own consequence to their health. Well, phosphorus is an element essential for all living beings and is thus critical in food production. Mined phosphorus rock is a non-renewable global resource that is nowadays becoming increasingly scarce, which poses a severe problem for the farming industry. It needs phosphorus in the form of fertilizers to sustain crop productivity. Well, crops have two entries into the human food chain. First, direct consumption or indirect consumption by rearing animals, which can be converted to human food. Different food types, therefore, require different amounts of phosphorus in their production. 1 kilogram, which is 2.2 pounds of phosphorus, can, for example, be used to either produce 3,330 kilograms of starch, meaning potatoes, or 16 kilos of beef. Now, think of that for a moment. 3,333 pounds of root vegetables could be produced, or 16 kilos of beef. Wow. So the loss of phosphorus in waterways, whether from agricultural fields through runoff or urban sewage through human excrement, can cause severe water quality degradation. And this leads to eutrophication, and that's an overgrowth of the algae blooms and other debris in the water. And these are harmful algae blooms, and it impairs our drinking water in recreational areas and fisheries. So as the human population increases, and it is, our long-term food security and water quality are therefore threatened by the increased demand for phosphorus fertilizers. And the research has shown that if we have a change in diet, that could be an important intervention. And what would be the effect, for example, of us shifting as a society towards a plant-based diet? Well, all the modeling efforts focused around calculating the phosphorus footprint, which is the amount of phosphorus mined to support one's diet. And using food intake data from the National Nutritional Survey, they calculated the citizens' total consumption of different food groups and their associated average phosphorus fertilizer required to produce these foods. And the estimate is that if we switched over to a reasonable plant-based diet, that we could have an enormous savings in phosphorus and in the quality of our soil. Big time. You would reduce your carbon footprint or phosphorus footprint by 72%. So that's great news. More reasons to become vegan. From Xinjiang University in China, the omega-3 fatty acids reverse lipotoxicity through induction of autophagy in fatty liver disease. So according to the report out, they took a look to see what happens when you take your omega-3 fatty acids on non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And they find that it is extremely beneficial. So simply in lay language, take your omega-3 fatty acids and have a healthier liver. Also from Harvard Medical School, they're saying water on the knee could be an early sign of Lyme's disease. So what are called spontaneous knee effusions, also known as water on the knee, can be a primary symptom of Lyme's disease, even when you don't know that you even have had a bullseye rash, another common Lyme disease symptom. This is published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. So just something to look for. Also, the final thing on coenzyme Q10 today is that it reverses cholesterol transport. This is from Sun Yat-yen University in Taiwan. And what they found was, according to this scientific report, that the more coenzyme Q10 that you use, you enhance your macrophage reversing cholesterol's transport via activator protein 1-miRNA-378. And that's a signaling pathway. And that means you can lower your cholesterol in a safe way. So that's good. Take your coenzyme Q10, lower your cholesterol. Also from Johns Hopkins University, sleep interruptions worsen your mood, and the more sleep you have interrupted, then the worse your mood is going to be. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Sleep. I don't think we need a study for that. I think that there's more than enough empirical evidence, but these people were subjected to 8 forced awakenings, and those with delayed bedtimes showed similar low positive mood and higher negative mood after the first night. So when you stay up too late and you wake up during the night and you're not sleeping restfully, then you're going to be in a bad mood. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Null. We're going to come back in a moment and take a look at the environment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Null. As you have been experiencing, if you listen to this radio program live or downloaded in the archives, we have been doing more reporting on the state of our environment than any other radio program in the world. We have also written more articles, 3 just in the last 2 weeks. We have 3 more articles to go in this series. These are all fully footnote and vetted for scholarship. Richard Gale and myself have been working on these, and I'd like to share our latest. And this one's about how bad is it? Why would I ask that question? Because there are a lot of economic and political and ideological points of view that must be taken into account before the truth is ever filtered through. For example, there are major industries the Coke industries, there are probably at least 100,000 manufacturing facilities in the United States that would be adversely affected if it was mandated, not voluntarily, but they had to change from fossil fuel to renewables, wave power, solar, wind, geothermal, and they're not doing it. In fact, when you see solar, which is good, those are independent groups of people who are capitalizing on the solar interest. There are over 18,000 minimally abandoned windmills. There's new technology that makes the old ones obsolete. There are ones that do not kill birds by the millions, don't make noise, and don't blight the landscape. And there's a whole new generation making the old generation, which were very expensive and environmentally dangerous, though they did produce some electricity, but not enough to make it financially justifiable. So you have companies that are going to say, okay, so let's say that, Gary, we take your advice and we start changing over. First, it's going to take anywhere from 5 to 10 years to change over. Secondly, it's going to cost a lot of money. Who's supposed to pay for this? Well, you profit from it. You pay for it. Well, no, we're not going to do that. In our current system, we, the people, always are on the hook to subsidize every major industry when it has losses, just like quantitative easing. That's the American public through the Federal Reserve, giving banks and other institutions over almost $80 billion a month. They could do that with what they want, and they didn't do anything to help us. So industries say the same thing. Well, we're not going to change and decommission a nuclear power plant. It takes 20 years to do that, minimally, and we have no place to put the spent fuel rods. You can say, well, why didn't you plan for that? Well, because we were so interested in convincing the public that it was too cheap to meter, and it was safe, and it was green. All lies. And so you've got to pay for it. And they're not wanting to pay for it, because if they started taking money from existing profits and shifting them over to renewables, you're looking at 10 years where the stock is not going to be getting you much return, and therefore institutions are going to drop the stock. Why? Because as a society, we invest not in what is the best investment for the country, the land, the people. We invest in what is going to give us the highest yield of return. And right now, even a 3.5% return is a huge return. And people are willing to take risks for that kind of high return, because otherwise there's a negative savings out there, meaning you can actually lose money when you invest it, but people are afraid of not knowing what to do with their money. And instead of being educated about how people should not be trying to grow their money, that's the worst thing you can do, in my opinion. You should protect the asset you have. The moment you want to grow your money, someone else is going to take advantage of what you don't understand. They're going to make a fee taking you into a position, and they're going to make a fee taking you out of a position. They don't lose anything going in or out. You do. And the new laws allow them to continue to put you into high-risk positions without you knowing the full extent of your risk, and they profit from it. It's called churning. They can churn your stock. Oh, buy this, buy that, sell this, sell that. Anyhow, people who are very unsophisticated can take a beating. Instead of just putting your money into something that you can see it's protected. Anyhow, industries are not going to change. None of the scientific conferences around the world have been mandated by law. Everything has been voluntary. Everything is pushed down the road. Like California, we're going to have electric cars by 2040. We're not going to have a society in 2040. So they have these utopian fantasies. They're completely unrealistic. The current politicians are not going to make changes because both the Democrat and Republican are beholden to these same industries and the major stockholders and the billionaires who control them. The average person, the average American, is not going to change their habits. They're going to continue to overconsume everything and create even more of a carbon footprint. Only a small percentage of the public is doing responsible purchasing, downsizing, and going to a plant-based diet. The wealthier you become in America today, including careerists, lawyers, doctors, engineers, architects, professors, accountants, small business people, the more they believe that they must buy in order to show that somehow they've arrived. They deserve their respect and deferment. Let's defer to that person. Look how rich they are. This massive, blind, mind-numbing overconsumption has created the problem. Who do you know who's going to say, our kid doesn't have to go to that private university and spend that $80,000 a year? Our children don't need to go to a mall with a shopping cart and buy stuff they don't need. No, that's not happening. To the contrary, we're eating more meat, more sugar, more dairy, drinking more alcohol, doing more polluting than ever before in our history. And yet, it's not because we have a lack of awareness. We have full awareness. We just choose not to act on it. So then we're left with the earth. And the earth and climate change are being neglected, big time, by everybody. The earth system science, a relatively recent multidisciplinary approach to better understanding the daunting complexities of climate change and ecological sustainability, is founded on the understanding that the earth may seem to be isolated systems, one system here, system there, another system there, acting co-independently with each other. Our planet, or Gaia, is an enormous system of networks. And we need to quickly adapt our minds to this holistic way of perceiving our home on this earth. Causes and their effects are not only local events, but carry global significance and influence through a composite web of interrelationships that wraps around the entire world and its numerous biosystems. Consequently, climate events experienced in the north, Canada, the Arctic, the northern plains of America, Scandinavia, all that can be felt in the south, and vice versa. There's no part of our world that is truly isolated from another. Melting ice in the Arctic contributes to the rising tides and frequent flooding in Miami. An ice-free Arctic and loss of the Greenland's glacier sheets will generate substantial imbalances throughout the northern hemisphere and force tropical zones to migrate further north. The sands from the great dust storms in the African Sahel are felt in the air above Houston. The Amazon's tropical rainforest now threatened to be leveled for corporate profit by the current Bolsonaro's, the new fascist. He is even worse than Trump, and I thought that would be hard to be that dumb and that insensitive to everything in life. But he is, and he's now running Brazil. And that is one of the world's largest environmental filters, the great Amazon rainforest. It filters by reprocessing humanity's toxic output, releasing oxygen back into the atmosphere. And the loss and drying of the Amazonian means less rainfall and snow in the American Northwest and the Sierra Nevadas. In the north, the great boreal forests stretching from Canada across Russia and Siberia and Scandinavia is one of the last remaining natural habitats for numerous species left on the planet. This region contains the world's largest wetlands that store over 25% of human carbon emissions, and more than all tropical forests combined. It is also crucial for keeping the Arctic cooler. Unfortunately, according to the Canadian Forest Service, the rate of boreal wildfires has doubled just in the last 20 years. And in the south, the warming of tropical ocean basins is relentlessly screaming back as fiercer storms traveling further into the mid-latitudes. Now, perceiving our world as a complex network of co-independent relationships between living ecologies known as biomes and the Earth's physical systems, the biosphere, the geosphere, the hydrospheres, etc., that account for sustaining life is now absolutely essential for preparing ourselves for the increasing abnormal changes ahead as the planet gets hotter. Many scientists are now warning that simply reducing or even ceasing fossil fuel emissions altogether is insufficient to turn back the tide on climate change. As recent as 2014, the World Meteorological Organization, following an analysis by NASA satellite footage of carbon dioxide movement around the planet, concluded that our warming planet has entered, quote, uncharted territory at frightening speed. For this reason, climatologists frequently underestimate the swiftness of climate-related events. Statistical and computational simulations are grossly limited for portending timeless events. They've been going on for a long time, but they're accelerating. They're not going to stop. These timelines warn us, and we're not heeding the warnings of what weather conditions are impacting the environment. And for this reason, the most recent International Panel for Climate Change, the IPCC, has given us a dire report. Now, they've been criticized, and rightly so, by many scientists for being way too conservative. If they were a person, they'd be Rush Limbaugh. The report estimates that humanity has 12 years to seriously tackle the problem of humanity's contribution to accelerated global warming. Recently, I had Paul Beckwith, professor, climatologist at the University of Ottawa, explaining on this program that the IPCC's methodology, based upon systematized gradual metrics to determine the rate of climate change, was wrong. Although highly sophisticated, the IPCC's models are still lacking and unable to account for all the anomalous variables, particularly actual weather and environmental events such as unforeseeable catastrophes like mammoth biomass emissions from wildfires, Category 4 and 5 superstorms, and other natural and human calamities. Nor do these models take into account the many positive feedback loops that interfere with a gradual simulated approach. Therefore, Professor Beckwith and others that we've interviewed would reduce the IPCC's 12-year threshold by as much as 5 years. So here's the bottom line. Instead of 2030, humanity may be facing only 7 years until 2025 to make a 180-degree turn on a sustainable track and avoid an inevitable apocalyptic future. The Arctic is the key region climate scientists focus upon with the highest worry. Very soon, the Arctic region will be ice-free throughout the year. Conservatively, the region will lose all of its ice during the warmest months before 2030. At one time, many scientists were unable to conceive that the Arctic would be ice-free before the 2070s or later. That's all changed. They were all wrong. Everyone was wrong. For 2017, the second hottest year on record globally, temperatures are comparable to those that ended the last ice age. Now, with Canadian summers getting steadily hotter and winters milder, some are calculating this blue ocean event may be reached by 2022. That's just 3.5 years from now. We still don't know precisely many of the long-term consequences to the polar region and the planet's weather patterns and biosystems once no winter ice forms in the Arctic. We're going to find out soon. The year 2017 was also a record-breaking year for extreme weather and environmental catastrophes since records started to be kept in the 19th century to the present. The Arctic experienced temperatures up 70 degrees above normal, and 2018 temperatures of 45 degrees above normal. Siberia was more freakish, with a 100-degree Fahrenheit swing in temperatures within a two-week period. It's never happened in history. This was recorded in a town which the Washington Post reported is, quote, the coldest permanently occupied human settlement in the world. Human emissions of greenhouse gases have caused the Arctic to heat up twice as fast as the remainder of the Northern Hemisphere. This has contributed to two major positive feedback loops. And by the way, a positive feedback loop, which should worry all of us, is when a system is placed under extreme stress. It affects another force, which in turn intensifies and pushes the momentum of the initial system. Consequently, that system accelerates in the direction it is being forced towards. A positive feedback, therefore, forces an increase in net temperature change. Let me give you a very good example of this. I lived in South Beach for 15 years, second in Ocean Drive. When I bought my apartment, there was no building there. It was a ghetto. But I knew that this would be a place that people would be moving to, and it was right across from a park in front of the ocean, so it was kind of ideal, and it was. It was a wonderful, beautiful place to wake up in the morning, to go out, and to go for a 10-mile run on the beach when no one was out, early in the morning, come back, make myself a juice, sit out on the balcony, do my writing, and then go in and do my broadcasting at a portable radio studio there. And it was one of the finest places I could imagine. Walk up to Lincoln Road, the most beautiful street in all of America, one of the most beautiful roads in the world, and just enjoy the energy. There was no car traffic on that 8-block stretch. Great culture from all over the world. And all that changed one day when I saw that in the morning, as the tide goes out, comes in the evening, goes out in the morning, it leaves a line of seaweed. And I started seeing month after month, it was going further inland. Also, I began to see something I'd never seen before. Large barges pulling up near the shore and bulldozers taking whole barges of sand off and then smoothing it on the beach and running tractors up and down to keep it smooth, because people go to Miami Beach for the beach and the great volleyball and sunning and funning. And I'm thinking, this isn't right. Is this an anomaly? And after 2 years, I saw it was not an anomaly. I started doing all the research, and I found that all the buildings from the Keys clear up the whole coast of Florida, none of them are built on rock. They're built on sand. They have concrete pilings driven down, but they're sitting on sand, just like in Dubai. All the beautiful architectural masterpieces, they're all going to get, you know, destroyed because the underlying foundations are being swept away as the tides come in and surge and they go out. More sand is pulled away. And that's why all that sand every morning was being pulled back into the ocean. I didn't realize that the deficiency of sand in the world because of all the concrete we make using sand is a major pandemic environmental crisis. We're running out of sand worldwide. Even in Miami, I found out that they had no sand in the United States. Can they get any more? Not even the Bahamas are having to go further and further away to bring in their sand. So that's on a death watch. In any case, after 7 years of watching this, one morning, I came back and it struck me. I just stood there and looked at it. I saw seaweed on the bottom outer wall of the swimming pools behind the hotels. That meant that the water was going up and then down into the sand, a lot of it, and then down, and it would start gradually and slowly destabilizing those pylons, which would then cause cracks in the structures, which in time would make them unlivable. So it's not, is Miami dead? It's dying. And yet people are living in denial of it. And then one night I walked over to Alton Road, which is on the west side of South Beach, and you walk up, and there was 18 inches of water. And I thought maybe water main broke. No, this is just how far in the tides are coming. And this went on for a year, and that's when I sold my apartment. And it would be worth a lot more if I kept it, but I believe in getting out of harm's way when you can do so in a mindful an intelligent way and plan where the next sustainable place will be. It was a great place until it wasn't. It was the right place till it wasn't. And now it's not. Now they're going to have to move all of Miami, all of it, and Boca, and Fort Lauderdale, and West Palm Beach. All that's going to have to be moved back. You're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. And still, all the aquifers that supply all those people with water, the seawater is going into them and pollutants going into them after the hurricanes. So their aquifers are polluted. The water's coming in. Now, that's a positive feedback loop because as glaciers melt around the world, the Himalayas are melting. The great northern altitude glaciers are melting. Antarctica is melting. Greenland is melting. That causes the water to go inland at a low point, which is Miami in Florida. That's a positive feedback loop. So a more recent feedback mechanism, primarily observed in Greenland, is the ice sheet's albedo has been observed to lessen before ice actually melts. And when ice crystals are jagged, more light is reflected. However, with the warming of the ice crystals, they become rounded and their potential effect of throwing light back into the sky decreases. And according to one environmentalist, between 2000 and 2011, Greenland's albedo for a single month's average decreased 9% in 1 month in this manner. And a third feedback loop is the annual increase in major wildfires around the globe. In 2017, Greenland experienced its largest wildfire on record from the burning of thawed peat land. Now, peat, P-E-A-T, has the ability to self-ignite. And in 2018, British Columbia experienced the loss of over 3.2 million acres, and the Northwest Territories lost 8.4 million acres in just 1 year. So northern wildfires, too, are interconnected with the melting of the Arctic as tons of carbon soot settle upon the Arctic regions of ice and the glaciers, thereby absorbing more heat and further reducing the impact, increasing it. So a more recent discovery that should be deeply disconcerting for any slight chance that the Arctic might revert to its current course is the self-perpetuating effect of Arctic ice loss on the climate of Northern Europe and North America, including the United States. This concerns the powerful polar jet stream that steers weather systems around the Northern Hemisphere from the west towards the east. And this air current establishes a boundary separating the cold and wet climates in the north from the warmer and drier southern climes. And research now shows that as the Arctic warms, which it's doing, the jet stream weakens, and this is contributing to the increases in severe extreme weather conditions. And Professor Francis Rutgers University headed up a NOAA study to determine the effects of a warming Arctic on extreme weather events, such as the recent superstorms of the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. And she concluded, quote, as the Arctic warms, at twice the global rate, we expect an increased probability of extreme weather events across the temperate latitudes of the enormous hemisphere where billions of people live, end quote. Now, that's only one half of the article. The entire article you will be posted today on prn.fm. The other two are already posted. Please download it. Share it with everyone you can. It's important that you understand how bad it is, how we're running out of time, and that the entire Northern Hemisphere has been an exponential leap in extreme weather events, including massive wildfires, severe droughts, heat waves, and flash floods. And just imagine Harvey, Irma, Maria, Florence, Michael, just during the past 18 months, all because of temperate climate zone changes. So, I'm not even getting in now, but in the article I do get into the food that's grown in these temperate zones as Europe, the United States, Canada, and Northern Mexico, China, and the Middle East, and most of Russia are impacted, and how that's going to affect billions of people having anything to eat. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. On the line now from California is Jonathan J.B. Handley, and we're going to talk about the causes, the real causes behind the autism epidemic and how to end it. Jonathan is the co-founder, along with his wife, of Generation Rescue, a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to sharing information with parents to help them recover their children from autism. The Handleys are also parents of a son with autism. He received his degree from Stanford University and for much of his career worked in the private equity industry. He also worked closely with British physician Andrew Wakefield in the lead-up to his hearing and trial in the United Kingdom over the controversies of his research on the MMR vaccine and autism relationship. Last month, he published How to End the Autism Epidemic, which backs the argument with some of the best current science to prove that the debate over vaccines and autism is far from being settled. His website is jbhandley.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Gary, thank you for having me.
Before we begin, I'd like to offer a side note. With only 2 weeks upon release, your recent book was assaulted on Amazon with over 256 reviews, and the vast majority of those are negative, which resulted in only one star rating. I share this information because as an author myself, I know it takes much longer for books to get reviewed on Amazon, and very rarely at that pace unless they are controversial to the status quo and highly relevant. It's also extremely doubtful that even a tiny fraction of these reviews actually read your book, as we have been reporting for the past year about Wikipedia and the science-based medicine cult within the skeptic movement. This is one of the targeted strategies largely orchestrated by the skeptics tech guru, Tim Frowley, that is frequently used to rapidly disparage any book skeptics disapprove of on Amazon in order to reduce potential sales. The good news is that after more people had read the book in the following weeks, it reached a 4.5 star out of 5. But that fact that a book has been targeted for discrediting at such length is an indication of its significance. So when I consider the debate over the vaccine-autism connection, it has many sharp similarities to the same kind of psychology behind climate change denial. Denialists will not argue that the climate is changing. They deny that human civilization is responsible for it. And likewise, the denialism in the pro-vaccine camp, and the people like Paul Offit and Richard Pan, is to acknowledge that autism is real, but its singular cause is genetics and human biology, and immunology has little to do with it. In fact, there's even denial that autism epidemic exists because the definitions keep changing. Having said that, just people need to understand the science of climate change is to realize how we are bringing about our own extinction. We also need to understand the biological science behind vaccines and the physical, neurological, and psychological harm it does to infants, toddlers, children, and now young adults with human papilloma vaccine. So when we speak about the biological causes for autism, we're actually speaking about epigenetic principles, environmental agents like various toxic ingredients in vaccines that alter or interfere with proper biomolecular functions. Even with those who hold the genetic theory behind autism, a study of about 100 of these so-called autism genes was found by researchers at the University of Montreal to be primarily de novo genes, meaning they were not inherited from the parents, but were mutations or polymorphisms in utero. And again, this leads to an environmental agent as the cause, such as mercury or aluminum or another toxic chemical in the mother already. So please explain why there is such animosity against the biological basis for autism, and then talk about the limitations of the genetic basis argument that is the flagship theory for the feds and vaccine makers and pro-vaccine advocates? And then what does the latest science actually show are the principal causes of autism? The form is yours.
Great questions, all of them. I would clarify that today on Amazon, I have about 90% five-star reviews. So many of those early reviews were removed by Amazon because none of them had read the book. They just tried to, bring down the overall rating. And my book actually peaked at 44 on Amazon. It's still in the top 1,000. And Publishers Weekly, I made the bestseller list one week as well, which was a big surprise given that the mainstream media won't touch my book and won't discuss it at all. The number one reason that this debate continues is because vaccines have become a $60 billion industry versus a $300 million industry in the mid-1980s. And the vaccine schedule has expanded, as you well know, massively since the mid-1980s because we indemnified vaccine makers from liability. And like every other environmental agent that ended up poisoning people, those profiting from it work hard to deny that, whether it's tobacco or DDT or lead in paint or lead in gasoline or very recently glyphosate in Roundup. They try to obscure this debate as much as humanly possible, despite the growingly so obvious connection between vaccines and autism, as exhibited by literally hundreds of thousands of parents around the world having the exact same story about what happened to their children. So the reason for the denial is the profits. And I go through in detail in my book, How to End the Autism Epidemic, discussing the playbook that tobacco really perfected in terms of not only doing what the tobacco companies call distracting research, right? Poorly done research that barely reaches a conclusion that you then beat people over the head with to claim that there's no connection. And beyond that, just sowing seeds of doubt. And so you hinted about that in the fact that they even deny that we have an autism epidemic. Some do. And that's a way of sowing seeds of doubt that keeps well-meaning people on the sideline from actively engaging in this debate. And the thing that has changed, and I hope changed permanently in terms of where the science is going, the thing that's really changed in the last 10 years, which in scientific terms is a very short period of time, is that there is clear, unequivocal biological science, different from epidemiology that the CDC has relied upon to obscure this issue. Biological science, meaning that vaccines are given to mice and other animals, their brains are analyzed, and the outcomes revealed. And what the biological evidence shows unequivocally is that injected vaccines cause brain damage. Not only do they cause brain damage, but they trigger biomarkers, right? Markers in the blood, markers in the brain, markers in the spinal fluid, whatever it might be. They trigger biomarkers that we already know are consistent with autism. And in my book, I walk through this in sort of talking about 11 separate discoveries by scientists from all over the world that when looked at completely shows a clear biological basis for not only how a vaccine can cause autism, but I think as importantly, autoimmunity. We have a chronic autoimmunity epidemic amongst our children and amongst people in general, and it is clear that vaccines are the primary trigger of that. So that would be things like food allergies and asthma and diabetes and so many other autoimmune disorders where vaccines are implicated as the cause. And so I think we're on a precipice where, as you well know, Gary, historically, the mainstream media has tried to pit this issue as, you know, angry and distraught parents versus the science, right? The science, this sort of all-knowing, omniscient, the science. But that's not true. We have so many scientists from all over the world who are saying the exact same thing that the parents are saying about the cause and effect for most children. I don't think every case of autism is caused by vaccines, but most children where vaccines serve as a primary trigger to send them into autism. So it's a new day. I've been in this fight since 2005. It's a very different day now with so many scientists around the world. By the way, very few of them are American, standing up and saying, no, there's a biological basis here that explains what's happening and supports what all these parents have been saying for decades.
There is some science I would like to have you touch upon regarding the most recent research that supports the biological basis for autism and makes vaccines a prime suspect. For years, the vaccine autism debate has focused on only two main issues, the MMR vaccine that is associated with Andrew Wakefield's work and the use of mercury or thimerosal as a vaccine preservative that has been the main focus of Robert Kennedy Jr.'s efforts. But kids are now getting almost 40 vaccines, not just the MMR and the flu shot containing the mercury. What about the others and the ingredients they share in common, notably aluminum compounds? And even the Nobel laureate, Luc Montagnier, has publicly warned about vaccines that contain aluminum. So share the most current science coming out of France, Christopher Exley in the United Kingdom, Canada's Christopher Shaw, and others that should convince us that we need to be focusing on aluminum right now and how vaccines contain aluminum, so that if kids consistently receiving aluminum-containing vaccines, they're getting an awful lot of aluminum in the body and in the brain, and we're not paying attention to that.
Great question. And I do personally believe, based on the science I've reviewed, that aluminum is probably the primary trigger. And let me explain. When my son was 2 months old, he goes into the pediatrician's office. He gets 6 vaccines simultaneously, right? Simultaneously, within 10 minutes of each other. His physical health declines precipitously. As a parent, I don't know which of the ingredients in that shot got my son. I just know how he presents after that appointment. And so over time, through the efforts of parents and then brave doctors like Andy Wakefield, et cetera, we've been exploring what is it about the vaccine specifically that's hurting children. Mercury was in many vaccines. That seemed like an obvious place to start. As you know, mercury is in a vaccine to serve as an antibacterial, right? So if it's a multi-dose vial, the mercury in there is supposed to kill bacteria that may be brought in by a syringe coming into the vial. What we now know, because of newly published science, is that the aluminum serves a very, very different purpose for a vaccine. It's an adjuvant, which means by definition, its purpose is to hyperstimulate the immune system. We now know that if you hyperstimulate the brain's immune system, and you do that during fragile moments of brain development, you can trigger autism. And so the work coming out of England specifically, France specifically, and Canada specifically has served to surround that topic with very clear science. So Christopher Shaw in Canada, what he showed unequivocally is that the aluminum in vaccines destroys motor neurons. Okay, so they gave this stuff to mice, and the mice became almost completely disabled. And so he knew that it was a profound neurological toxin. What Girardi and his group found in France is that not only does the aluminum stay in the body far longer than people believed, but it actually, what happens is it's injected in tiny little amounts under the skin. Macrophages, which is the immune system sort of garbage man, they grab the aluminum, which they don't recognize because the aluminum is in a nanoparticulate form when it's put inside a vaccine, which means it's man-adjusted from its natural state. The macrophage doesn't recognize it, so it gets stuck in the macrophage, and then the macrophage heads to the brain, and then the brain's immune system reacts against the aluminum. So not only did the French discover that this aluminum was biopersistent, meaning that it stayed in the brain much longer than people had thought, they also discovered that smaller doses of the aluminum given more often were far more likely to end up in the brain. A large bolus dose of aluminum, the body will usually sort of grab it and keep it right where it came into the body. But in these smaller doses, it kind of sneaks its way in. And then Professor Exley, in late 2017, he being the preeminent neurotoxicologist in the world with his expertise being aluminum, discovered that people with autism, when he looked at their brains after they had died for other reasons, had much higher levels of aluminum in their brains than any other brains they'd ever seen. But perhaps more importantly, it was the location of the aluminum in the brains that he was deeply disturbed by, because it was largely in the macrophages. And as he described, it's like a Trojan horse mechanism where it's brought into the brain by the macrophages. And one of the problems that we've had with aluminum historically, Gary, is that the safety measures for aluminum have been based on a different form of aluminum ingested, right, brought in through the mouth, versus injected in a nanoparticulate form. You can't use a different form brought into the body in a different way to determine safety levels. And these three scientists specifically, who you named, Girardi out of France, actually out of England, and Shaw out of Canada, they were so disturbed by the American standards for aluminum safety, they each wrote their own letters to our public health service asking them to revisit this topic, warning them that they believe the conclusions on their websites that vaccines don't cause autism is inaccurate, saying that the safe levels for aluminum are poorly derived and should be reconsidered. They even published a whole article about this topic, about the U.S. measures for aluminum safety. So we're at a crossroads where there's a tremendous amount of conflict within the scientific community, with many scientists standing directly with the parents. And to date, we haven't seen our public health service move in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. It got so extreme, if you will, that Professor Chris Exley, who's from Keele University, a very renowned, well-established mainstream scientist, after doing the brain-based research on people with autism, went so far as to say, if I were a parent, I would think very hard about whether to ever give my child a vaccine that contained aluminum. It's pretty extreme and pretty crazy. And yet in the mainstream press, this is still parents versus the science, which is no longer remotely true.
I appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights with us. And people can go to your website for more information. And for that...
Yeah, Gary, I...
Go
to jbhandleyblog.com, jbhandleyblog.com. You can find my most recent writings there.
Okay, good. Thank you very much, JB, for being on today. We appreciate it.
Gary, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
JB Handley from California. He's out there, he and his wife, fighting the good fight with Generation Rescue and helping people better understand autism, because we're not getting the truth from our mainstream scientists, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and any of the governmental agencies and the pro-vaccine advocates. We'll share it with you here, though. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.